Welcome to the Become Nomad podcast, where you're already a nomad or aspiring to become one. We're here to supply you with relevant information to help keep you on the road until you settle down in a small Portuguese village and enjoy coffee and wine. The introduction for this episode is actually recorded in a village close to Porto, the second largest city in Portugal, which doesn't mean much because Portugal is relatively relaxed and small, and Porto is also, as a city, is charming. To add to that, I picked a village close by because villages are so much better, especially if they're connected to a big city easily. As a side note, Portugal is becoming the place to be for digital nomads in Europe. It offers a lot of benefits of reasonably good weather, great food, amazing coffee, as I mentioned, and the good and cheap wine. And in general, low cost of living in comparison to West Europe. Although this is changing because Portugal suffered a very big economic crisis in 2008, even more than Spain, and it's now rebounding very fast. It's actually the fastest growing economy now in Europe, so take advantage of it when it's still possible until the next crisis. Now, as for Portugal in general, Lisbon is the most popular city in Portugal, and that's the capital of Portugal. However, you have a lot of charming villages and other cities all over the country, and I generally try to pick not the most popular city in the country. That's why I was spending a lot of time in places like Bucaramanga or Odessa. Bucaramanga in Colombia, Odessa in the Ukraine. So that fits my strategy of finding a smaller city and in this place actually locate a village. I'll just say that I arrived here in April, and for a good reason. Basically, I'm trying to avoid the summer rush that happens in locations close to the sea, and everything in Portugal is actually almost close to the sea. It's like a strip of land just by the ocean. And the idea over here is basically to spend a few months in Portugal before high season starts. And just a note about high season, July and August in Europe, you probably want to avoid any place close to the sea unless you have very big budget, because that's where basically the prices shoot up. And before we start, we're just going to do a small sponsor intro. And as you know, nobody wants to sponsor this podcast, so of course I'm sponsoring myself. And this time we're going to speak about Startup Link, the global startup ecosystem app and research center. What's happening there is that if you have a startup, an innovative startup, then registration is basically free to put yourself on the map amongst of tens of thousands of other startups, co-working spaces and accelerators. So if you only also have a co-working space or accelerator, definitely relevant for you. Startup Link also offers a marketing blast package that is relevant to any type of project and service provider. This includes writing an article about you in our top-ranked blog, 45 minutes of consultation with yours truly, and directory submission to more than 100 business directories around the world. So if you want to check it out, you can go to validation.startuplink.com. Startup Link is with a B. Just as a side note, Startup Link is also a research center of startup ecosystem. So if you're interested in knowing how well your city and country rank compared to other places in startup activity, then we basically rank more than 900 cities and more than 120 countries, and you can see it below the map. I think generally that as a digital nomad, we should care about the quality of the startup ecosystem where we go to. It's directly correlated to how alive the place is, how much activity there is in general, because startups are all about innovation, fun, events, and so on. So it really connects. It's no wonder that actually the biggest startup hubs are very active and vibrant cities like San Francisco, London, New York, and Berlin. So definitely worth having this as an additional consideration when you pick your place, and basically this ranking that we've built can help. And yeah, and speaking about startups, we have a really exciting and inspiring interview. I don't do a lot of interviews, only when I really feel like I have a really good opportunity of getting valuable insights. So we did this interview actually in Chiang Mai about a month and a half ago. It's the same coffee shop where we did the last interview, so we're gonna have a lot of birds, cars, and also planes over our heads. And those parts were cut out because it can get super, super noisy and they pass all the time. And this interview is with Chris Kirkland. And a really exciting interview for me because Chris is the co-creator of the Hobo CEO with Nico. Hobo CEO is one of my favorite podcasts ever. It's a charming, relaxed, and insightful podcast. And unfortunately, it was frozen a few years ago, but Chris says he's gonna take care of it soon, so hopefully that will happen. Now, Chris is a serious hobo CEO. We can all learn from. He started moving around after an extended vacation in Goa in 2004, when there was practically no information about the trend of digital nomadism and so on and so on. So imagine 2004, that's way, way before I even thought about the option of moving around. So really connecting to what he thought back then, and I think it's super valuable. He started developing his own IT skills and then started launching various side projects, and we're gonna talk about this concept, which I think is the most valuable in this interview. There are many, many interesting insights here, but the concept of side projects is incredibly insightful. I suggest to put special attention in this part because this can really change the way that your career is developing and your, let's say, goals are developing as well. So two of those side projects, artweb.com and tokyochipo.com, actually evolved, and Chris is going to speak about that. And that's basically it. That's Chris' methodology, is basically launching side projects, sees what works and kind of freezes the others to dismay of the fans, like the Hobo CEO fans. So I hope you enjoy it. Bye-bye. Okay, so with us today is Chris Kirkland. I did a short introduction about him before, so we're all set to go. I have to tell you, Chris, it's a pleasure to have you here because I listened for a long time to your podcast, so you're kind of a friend to me without even knowing you before we met today, so thanks for being here.
Awesome, thanks for inviting me. Very flattered to listen to all of our episodes. Makes me very happy.
Yeah. I also have this when someone tells me that they listen to the podcast from time to time, I'm shocked that there are real people that are actually listening. So that's pretty cool. Chris, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the story of you, maybe before you started the revolutionary part of life, let's say the 9-to-5 part. If there was there a normal part?
There was never really a normal part. I've never had a job.
Wow, okay.
I had university summer jobs. I studied mathematics at university in Brighton in the UK, finished university, and then decided, no way am I going to work for somebody else. I'm going to figure something out. And I just went through this period of trying all kinds of different things. I was good with computers, and this was like in the early, mid-90s, when the internet was really early and nobody understood technology, but people were trying to use computers. So I made money just like going around to people's houses and fixing their computers.
Wow.
And then that transitioned into doing web programming and web design, because one of the computers I ended up fixing belonged to this businessman, and he's like, oh, can you make websites? I was like, yeah. And I knew a bit of HTML, and I mean, nobody knew how to make websites back then. This was the era of the blink tag and all this kind of stuff. All the while I was kind of fiddling around doing this tech stuff, I was also trying to be a musician. I was in bands, writing music, recorded an album once. So like my kind of real passion for the first 10 years of my adult life was music. Young, ambitious 22-year-old, you know, you always think you can do anything. So I had a partner that I was working with, and he had the idea of setting up this recording studio and getting this building and having an art space. We had all these kind of crackpot ideas, and I just guess, to cut a long story short, that all crashed and burned terribly and ended up leaving me with some debts. But fortunately I had these IT skills which managed to kind of dig me out of that hole. And it was kind of as I was sort of digging myself out of that hole, And I realized that it would be smarter to create a web business rather than just being a sort of consultant.
Yeah.
And, you know, rather than just selling my time by the hour, having something that would just sort of be a product or a service. Because some of the people that I was working for, that's what they had. So I think about 2004, I realized that I could create a remote business that I could basically run from anywhere. And that's when I had a few ideas, but ArtWeb was the one that ended up working.
Yeah. So that's 2004, that's 3 years before Tim Ferriss. You were pretty fast. And I just want to transition to something that you spoke about, the skills. So this is something that apparently it seems like that if you're going on a non-conventional lifestyle, skill is one of the best weapons you can have, right? You would recommend people to basically focus on building a core skill?
Yeah, I think there's two things here. One is some people are just really good with people and they just do fine whatever happens because they can sell, basically. For the rest of us,
the normal people.
Everyone has a certain range of how good they are with people, but I think having some kind of skill, yeah, that without those IT skills, I think life would have been a lot harder. I wouldn't have had the opportunity or the money because it was just, at that moment in time, having IT skills was just gold.
Still, actually.
And yeah, I guess still, it's maybe not quite as easy as it was back in the 90s and early 2000s, but yeah, it's a good skill to have.
Yeah. I honestly don't have a skill. And life has been more difficult when something crashes and you kind of have to lift yourself.
Yeah.
I don't have a go-to skill that I'm saying, okay, let's say I don't have money and I'm left today with zero money.
Mm.
How can I make money even in the street, you know, somehow? Like some kind of a skill that you can do, even juggling or pyrotechnic. Mm. But IT is nowadays, I think, the best skill and the best paid skill as well. So if someone can focus on it, it seems like a good thing to do. The first part was pretty unconventional, but let's move to the even more unconventional part of moving this location independent part. So first of all, currently, did you have a period where you were defining yourself as a digital nomad? Were you part of this movement? You had a podcast about this, but
well, there wasn't a word for it when I was doing it.
Right.
I was just doing my thing. I knew nobody else that was living like this. I think I always liked the word hobo, digital hobo. I just thought that was funnier. And then, you know, people started, this word digital nomad came out, and I was like, kind of, just sort of conjures up this image of somebody on the African Sahara plains with a sort of shawl, but with a laptop. Like, I just thought it was a bit pretentious. I like the idea of a hobo, you know, you're sat in a park in, you know, jeans with holes in. I'm being British, having this sort of self-depreciating thing. I always like the term hobo. But yeah, as I was saying, when I started, there just wasn't a word for it.
Hobo is a little bit, you had the Hobo CEO podcast, which I listened to. I think that maybe it didn't pick up or couldn't pick up because there is a little bit of something decreasing in the term hobo. Like the minute that you say you're a digital hobo, whatever, maybe you're not that serious. And the digital nomad allows you to be cool, but at the same time, serious.
I'm always very self-depreciating. I prefer to kind of lower people's expectations than raise them. I prefer to surprise people with what I can do rather than sort of burst through the door claiming I can do all these things and then not being able to produce. So
I'm the same, actually. Yeah. No, that's interesting. The game of definitions. Actually, a lot of the Chiang Mai, where we are now, where we met, has a giant community of digital nomads. And when you look deep into their lives, you see that they're not really nomads. They just started out. So for me, the term is a little bit confusing because for me, you have to do it for a limited amount of time, one, and you actually have to transition from one place to another as a decision of life.
Mm.
And I have a feeling that currently it's just a hype term that doesn't have a lot behind it. So hobo, I'll consider. Can I introduce myself?
Please,
as a hobo?
Okay. Please.
That's great. So let's talk about what you mentioned, what this unconventional life, what was it? Focusing, let's say, on the location part, what were you trying to do in 2004?
So I realized that I just kind of had this moment where I realized I'd seen a few of my clients when I was writing website code for them. I saw that they had businesses that didn't seem to have like a location. You know, they were doing an online service, and I was actually working for some of them remotely anyway. So I was used to sort of being a coder, just working where my clients weren't and never meeting them. But I just, I think I'd been, I can't remember the actual chronology, whether I'd come up with the idea of Artweb, whether I was trying to kind of make a business or I was trying to go location independent. But I just had this moment where I realized with Artweb, I only need about 100 customers and then I've got enough money, you know, £20,000 a year. I was quite sort of humble, low goals back then. I just realized that's all I need, and I could just like spend most of my time on the beach in Goa.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe I was in Goa when I had that realization. Because that's like the first place I went. I went there for just kind of a sort of extended holiday. I didn't like think, all right, I'm going off. But so I just kind of realized that it would be possible fairly easily to have a business that didn't really require me to be anywhere. And so I was like, right, that's what I've got to do. And I suppose in terms of like the lifestyle and where I went, I quite quickly just got fixated on Japan. I decided, right, I want to go to Japan. And it's a bit of an unconventional sort of digital hobo, digital nomad choice, you know, go from...
It's expensive as well.
It's not that cheap. It's not that expensive, but it's not like going to Chiang Mai or India.
Yeah.
You know, you need sort of $2,000-$3,000 a month to basically just have a minimum living standard. And so, yeah, that was my first destination. And I stayed there for quite a long time. I didn't really travel much. It was just, that was the first place I went, and I really liked it and stayed. So it wasn't for a few years. I think I was in Japan like 2.5-3 years before I really got the itch and went to kind of full hobo mode. Like, I did a few holidays while I was in Japan. Like, we went to Berlin for a month, me and my girlfriend and one of her friends and my brother. We all rented an apartment in Berlin. And, yeah, I think that kind of just put the taste back in my mouth. And 3 months later, started a period of about 4 or 5 years where I was just moving every few months. Didn't really have a kind of residency anywhere.
Yeah, and since then, you're back to Japan as your home base, or you're still in the mode of moving around?
I'm kind of in a sort of hybrid state. Like, I'm a resident in Japan, a taxpayer in Japan, but I'm not there that often. It's, at the moment, it's about 6 to 8 months of the year, so I still kind of have this sort of taste of the hobo life. You know, I'm in Chiang Mai for a bit, maybe somewhere in Europe, Lisbon, Berlin, then back to Japan for a bit. So it's almost like it used to be. So I'm kind of like, you know, 3/4 of a hobo.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. It's better than not being a hobo at all.
It's a nice balance. I think, you know, the few people I know who have been kind of longer term living this lifestyle, it seems to be that's what people converge on. Like, it's like having your cake and eat it. You know, I've got an apartment and I've got a lifestyle in Tokyo. You know, I've got some friendships there which I've developed over years. The kind of thing that's harder to get when you're on the road, you know, you can't have a drum kit if you're a digital nomad,
right? Yeah.
But if you have an apartment somewhere, you can at least have a drum kit for half the year or whatever.
Oh, that's a good one. So you would, the idea of having some kind of a home base is relaxing a little bit, right? There is something, me personally, I don't have one, but that's the question I get most of the time, like, how can you keep on moving without a place you call home? But for some reason, I never felt I needed it. But for you, it's good that you have it. Some kind of a anchor, right?
I think it helps. But I don't know. I guess it's been a few years since I haven't had an anchor. And, you know, I feel like I don't need it. But maybe if I didn't have it anymore, I'd miss it again. It's difficult to really analyze because I have to... You know, your memory of what it was like in the past versus what it is like now. So, I mean, I'm really enjoying being in Chiang Mai. I'm really enjoying going to Europe every summer for a few months. But maybe I enjoy it more because I have that anchor to come back to. And I do remember there were points where I did feel a little bit adrift before.
Yeah.
And I think just that simple question of, oh, where am I going to be next month? I never have to think about it because I can always go back to my place in Tokyo.
Right. Okay. That's a good one. So maybe we'll speak a little bit about Tobo CEO, the podcast.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So can you tell us the story, basically, of how you started with Nico, how many episodes you've done, and maybe also why did you shut it down? Because that was a big disappointment to your fans.
Firstly, it's pause. It's an extended sabbatical. Okay. We really want to pick it up again. We met in Berlin, and we quickly realized that we were really on the same page about a lot of things. And we knew quite a few people who'd started podcasts, and we wanted to just kind of do something creative, have some sort of outlet. And we felt that we had something to offer because we were looking at life from a more philosophical perspective. We didn't want to do a sort of, 10 best destinations for digital hobos, digital nomads. We wanted to just talk about the observations that we made on life from this unusual perspective, because in a sense we've really kind of right at the top of that pyramid of needs. I think is it Maslow's pyramid of needs?
Yeah.
We're really so lucky. We're living this lifestyle that only really the very rich would have been able to live until quite recently. So, just lots of time and space to think and reflect.
Yeah.
And, leaving your kind of home country, leaving that environment, allows you to reflect a lot. Traveling, having this really great lifestyle, it just gives you more time to think and reflect. And so we felt like we wanted to just sort of bring our reflections from this unique perspective or unusual perspective. And that's why we started. And I guess it segues into also why we've paused, because it was also a very difficult podcast to do, because we're not like professional philosophers. None of us have written a book. We often think about these things, but it's not like we're really sort of sat there all the time working on our thesis.
Yeah.
So we've really struggled to come up with new things to talk about, and we didn't want to just do easy things like just talking about the lifestyle and tips for living on the road.
And you were saying you don't think you had a lot of downloads, it didn't really materialize into something, which makes me, it's a little bit funny, because every time you listen to a podcast of another person, you think that this is an empire. This is like the authority of nomadic lifestyle. I have to tell you, when I started the podcast, I was thinking my podcast transitioned into something totally different, but I was also thinking, am I too late? Because those guys are doing it so well. And I remember a funny story when I was actually at the day of Vastrip. I listened to 3 hours of your podcast on the same same day. I'm like totally overexposed. I went to Bulgaria.
Uh-huh.
And over there, there is something funny with Cyrillics, that wherever I went to, every shop, every bank, every whatever, they had the word hobo. And I have to tell you that for the first 2 hours, I was thinking to myself, Chris and Nico did something to actually penetrate a market that is very, very small, and they're just giant here for some reason. And then after 2 hours, I understood that hobo in Cyrillic is new. Novo.
Right, right.
So that was a little bit of...
So we're not big in Bulgaria after all.
You're not big in Bulgaria? I was sure you're in charge of Bulgaria. You're the bosses of Bulgaria. So, yeah, that's pretty cool.
I think one thing about the kind of topics that you and I talk about, Hobo CEO and your podcast, it's not sexy. People aren't, looking for philosophy. They're looking for... to solve their business problems or to solve their life issues. And, there are people that do seek philosophy, but it tends to come, you don't kind of go to Google and type philosophy podcast.
It's right.
Just kind of, it comes to you. Someone will say, hey, have you listened to Sam Harris yet? Or it just kind of comes to you obliquely. And I think it takes a long time for something like what we do to kind of gain momentum.
Yeah.
However, what I will say is we never really bothered too much about the numbers. I was just so pleased that certain people used to listen to the podcast who I really respect. I was like, if they're listening to it, I don't care how many downloads it is, because that's just, for me, that's success. That some people that I respect I look up to, you know, getting something from my podcast, you know, that's immeasurable. If you've got thousands of, basically, you could probably, there's certain hot topics, you could quite easily pick up thousands of downloads, even with a mediocre effort. So for me, I think the numbers are, it's not really the right way to measure the success of a sort of philosophical type podcast.
Let's talk a little bit about Japan.
Sure.
Japan, I know that you have Tokyo Chippo, which is basically one of the most authority sites on how to travel Japan for someone who is a little bit conscious of budget, right?
Well, everyone's conscious of budget at some level. But yeah, we started Tokyo Chippo 5 years ago. Me and a good friend, Greg, who's also an entrepreneur. And we were just like talking about ideas for new businesses, sort of side businesses. And we both agreed that nobody had done a guide to Tokyo on the cheap. It was just a sort of gap in the market. Because actually, Tokyo is not that expensive. It's got this reputation for being really expensive, but it's way cheaper than like London or Paris. It's more like a city like Berlin, which...
Oh, okay.
I guess it's probably a little bit more expensive than Berlin. Berlin is super cheap.
That's it's really becoming cheap. Expensive. Berlin is, from what I've seen, is transitioning into the tragedy of a successful place, you know, that is...
It's definitely changing. So we both realized that there was an opportunity to make a site about Tokyo on the cheap, because, for one, it was a really interesting city and it just wasn't as expensive as people thought it was. Just to cut a long story short, we were right. You know, that's what the world wanted. And we quite quickly grew to become basically the most popular English language site about Tokyo.
Okay.
You know, displaced all of the kind of, you know, incumbent authority sites. And since then we've spawned Japan Chippo to cover the whole of Japan. Also London Chippo, we started fairly recently.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we're planning to kind of expand and do other similar guides for other expensive cities.
That's pretty amazing how today you have the opportunity, something you wouldn't have 20 years ago, to kind of take over the big guys, right? The minute you find a topic that you find interesting, to kind of say, I'm not scared of Lonely Planet and all those guys, I'm just doing my own thing, and you can actually crush them, or not crush them, but you can actually be there. There can actually be a way to...
It's the age of the internet. I always remember Twitter, just thinking, what's Twitter doing that I can't already do with Facebook profile updates? You know, it was just such a minor iteration on the tools that we already had. And you could also say the same about like Facebook after MySpace. It was the same kind of thing, but just executed better, or had a few minor, seemingly minor differences. But it can just totally dominate it. It seems like you don't necessarily need to do a paradigm shift to kind of usurp and take over a market. You just need to be better. You just need to solve a particular problem that everybody has. I guess in the case with Tokyo Chippo, I think we had it quite easy, because I don't think there were that many high quality sites, to be honest. We just kind of took a good idea, like, you know, this brand Tokyo Chippo, it's quite funny, the concept is kind of what people were looking for, but also we just didn't suck on executing. And I think although there were kind of existing authority sites and kind of, you know, some magazines and stuff, they've kind of got lazy and their quality was not really up to speed with most of the internet. So we just kind of brought a kind of typical, when was it, 2014? We just kind of took the standards of 2014 to Tokyo.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good lesson for everyone who is listening that has some kind of a passion, and it's never too late to actually conquer a small niche, your own niche. So that's good to know. Yeah, Japan is interesting for me because I have the fear of a nomadic person in a way is stopping to be nomadic. And for some reason, I had two cities or two countries in the world that I was afraid that if I go there, that's it. I knew that I'm going to stop. And I actually was brave enough to test my assumption in 2013 with London and the UK. Horrible. Yeah, because as a kid, I saw the UK TV series and whatever and all this, and I felt like, okay, this is my place. I don't know why, but I said, okay, this is my place. I'm going there. I'm settling down there. I don't know how, but it's going to happen. And after a month in London, I just ran away like crazy. So it's pretty interesting that sometimes you build stories in your head about the perfect location, and it's not perfect. But Japan is the second place that I'm saying, okay, if I go there, there's a good chance that I would like to stay. So, but there is something about Japan in the sense of people going there and kind of saying, I'm staying.
Right? It's a certain type of person. You know, Japan isn't for everybody. I know lots of people. I guess it's the survivorship bias. The people that stay are the ones I know. And so it's other people like me who sort of turned up and decided to stay. I don't know all the people who left. But it does seem it's quite a sticky place, you know. I guess you haven't been to Japan yet.
No, I just saw how different it is. Like, in some ways, it's like different types of thinking at the world, right? That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's an alluring place, fascinating. You know. Still, I've been coming and going for a decade, and still, like, Tokyo's full of surprises. Still learning new things all the time. So Tokyo, it still stays interesting, you know. And in fact, the longer I stay there, the more it kind of opens up to me, because I get better at speaking Japanese. You know, a lot of things kind of unfold slowly in Japan. It's a very sort of slow place in some senses. And it's also a very comfortable place. It's so efficient and clean. Well, efficient in some senses. Maybe talk a bit more about that. It's almost like a utopian society, just so that everything works and it's very civilized. There's very little crime. Yeah, it's a very kind of comfortable place to be. But it does have its downsides. You know, you do have to be quite motivated to stay there, and you do have to be quite patient, because Japanese culture is very different from Western culture. I think it's very different from almost any culture, really. I have very different experience in Southeast Asia or India than I do in Japan. Like, it's even like Hong Kong, which is another developed city in Asia, it's just totally different from Tokyo. Yeah, it's not without its challenges, but if you can take on those challenges, it's very sticky. A lot of people get stuck there.
Good to know. So that's definitely on my list to test. I want to go back for a second on the podcast, something that I forgot to ask you. What do you think about the tribe? Like, is there a tribe of... You kind of gathered a small tribe with this podcast, but is there a tribe of people move from a place to a place? Like, is there
actually? Come to think of it, that's a good point. So over the years, I've met quite a few people that I really resonate with, because, you know, this lifestyle does select for a certain type of person. It tends to be open-minded, you know, curious, maybe a bit ambitious. So I've, you know, some of my closest friends now I've met through this lifestyle, through traveling. And often we don't necessarily travel all the time together, but we do aim to meet up in different cities. And so in a sense, there is a little bit of a tribe for me. And I think, you know, to broaden the tribe thing out, there's obviously lots of different tribes and communities, so it is like a thing. So I suppose I don't really self-identify too strongly with being location independent, you know, in the same way I don't self-identify with wearing shoes. It's something I do, but it's not really, it's just
nice.
I don't know, I don't really kind of think about it too much. And I have friends who are also location independent, also used to be location independent, and also have never been location independent. So for me, I'm not like too much of a sort of tribesman. But yeah, through this lifestyle though, I have kind of met some great people, and, you know, I suppose we try and meet up. In a sense, that's a bit like a tribe.
Yeah. That's actually fascinating. One of the biggest problems of this lifestyle, other than generating money to sustain it, is the loneliness element of it. So basically one of the things that you're doing, if I understand correctly, is trying to meet up with people in different locations. And it happens. It actually happens.
Yeah, yeah. This trip to Chiang Mai was, you know, I'm here because some other people are here.
Got you. So you basically know who is from your, let's say, community or circle of friends is currently moving into a place, and then you're saying, okay, here is an opportunity opens up to go there because X is there. So you're more interested in the people than the place itself.
Totally, right? Yeah.
Okay.
There's like four or five, I guess Chiang Mai is just such a hot spot. There's always people I know in Chiang Mai. But the main reason I'm here is like, you know, Nico is here and a few others. But if they'd decided to go to, I don't know, say Da Nang or Ho Chi Minh City or Penang, I would have gone there instead. You know, it was, I didn't want to come specifically to Chiang Mai, although I like it here. I wanted to come to spend time with them. I realized the, again, one of the downsides with the remote life is the social side, the loneliness. And I just kind of realized that you do meet a lot of people, and that's great, but there's some people I've met along the way who we really connect, and I really make an effort to stay in touch. Like, I schedule a Skype call, for example, Jesse, who does the Smart Drugs Smart podcast. I don't think we've met each other in person for like 3 or 4 years, but we Skype each other every few months. We're keeping up. So I really kind of think that that's something you have to, it's almost like you create a calendar event or an Asana task just to remind yourself, okay, yeah, I need to follow up, I need to kind of stay in touch.
The maintenance of your contact.
Yeah.
Although something interesting also happens, that you can be in a situation you haven't spoken with someone for years and still everything is okay when there is a chance, right?
If you really connect deeply, if you really kind of see the world in a similar way, then it's just sort of timeless. I think for kind of relationships where you're not quite overlapping so much, there's more of a sort of overhead to maintaining that relationship. But if you connect, it's just so much simpler. But still, I think it's important, or at least for me, I think it's important just to kind of remind myself to stay in touch.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about the social life. Let's talk a little bit also about maybe even something in the Maslow pyramid that is before the social life, which is basically making money, sustaining yourself. So we touched on it with the skill, which is basically something that you recommended, have a core skill. Any other quick tips? You know, everyone is building their own thing, but something that comes to mind to...
Yeah, the standard thing I always say is just try side projects. I don't know, even if you've got like a job, or better if you're doing something freelance, but even if you've got a job, you've still got some time to do side projects. And all of my businesses started as a side project. Back in the day when I was doing web development, like working for my clients, that was my main thing. ArtWeb was just one of the side projects I tried. And there's quite a few side projects that failed as well. But if you take on a side project, it's something you can do without this sort of all-in commitment. It's not like doing a startup where like you're all in until it kind of goes boom or bust.
Yeah.
Like a side project, something you can do, you can take your time, the stress is lower, and you can, you know, just try this again and again and again. You've got your main thing and you just try side projects.
That's amazing.
And it's like kind of building a sort of ship. You know, you're at land, but you're kind of building a ship, and maybe one of them sinks, but one of them actually floats and it allows you to sort of sail off into a new life.
Wow. Okay.
So the thing is just to try side projects.
And then basically test them with reality and see what sticks.
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to work, it's just going to kind of take off. It's like with ArtWeb, it was probably like my fifth business idea, I think. And basically, I did this really sort of crappy 2-week MVP, programmed it myself, and I emailed a load of local artists saying, I built the system that you can use to make your website. And I kind of put a PDF application form in there. Like 2 weeks later, somebody posted in a check, an application form. I was like, wow, I've made a sale. It basically just sort of took off. Because this is the thing with businesses, is like some of them fail, some of them do okay, and some of them just like take off. And the point is, the more things you try, the more likely you're going to get something that works or takes off. So just trying multiple side projects, I think, is just the best step into entrepreneurship. you're not like committed to one thing. You know, if you go all in, tell your friends and family, yeah, I'm starting this business, but then if it fails, everyone's like, okay, well, go back to your job. But if you're just like doing stuff on the side, you don't even need to tell people, you can just sort of do it, and if it just takes off naturally, then you just get on that ship and sail off.
And Tokyo Chipo was also another side
project? Another side project, yeah.
Okay, that's amazing. It actually worked for you then.
Yeah, now it's like way bigger than ArtWeb.
Yeah. No, this is a very good takeaway. I actually tell this to people about the nomadic lifestyle. When they say, how do I start a nomadic lifestyle? I say, don't declare that you have a nomadic lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
Do it as a side traveling project. Yeah, yeah. And if it sticks, great. So you don't... I noticed that the declaration phase can be very... It can put you in a very stressful situation.
Yeah.
Also with the business that everyone's... I love this side project idea.
I mean, there's this term, you know, the term burning your ships.
No.
So I think it was... I forget which European nation it was, but maybe... Let's say the Spanish. Maybe I'm getting it wrong, but... One of the European colonialization of South America, they arrived and there was like the kind of natives who were maybe hostile. It might not even be South America. Let's forget where it is. But this sort of force arrives and the general burnt all of their ships. So they couldn't go back. There was no way for them to go back home except for conquering the place that they'd landed, or at least sort of managing to make some kind of thing where they could build a ship and get back again. So that idea of just going all in, it does give you a certain sort of determination. But I think in this day and age, you can't really burn your ships because most people are fortunate enough to have friends and family and things to fall back on. So I don't know. I think like by declaring that you're doing this thing, it does give you a certain level of motivation. But some people that can work well for, I think. You know, the side project methods work very well for me. And I think it's just thinking about it mathematically, it's just like rolling a dice. There's so much luck in business and success. The best way to turn the odds in your favor is to roll the dice as many times as possible.
That's amazing. Because I noticed that most startups that fail because there is no demand. And this is something you're not going to be able to know until you launch it. So the idea of launching fast a few things and just seeing if organically something happens makes so much sense.
Yeah.
So that's a very good attitude. So thanks for that. I think that some people, also something nice about the side project is the lack of preparation needed.
Mm.
And I've noticed a lot of people are stuck in the preparation phase. This is maybe more than half of the people that have a problem with the business is currently because they're stuck in the theoretical ground, the philosophical ground,
what
we like, actually.
Yeah.
So basically, it looks like you're very focused on philosophy in general, but in business, you're very practical. Right?
Well, after making as many mistakes as I have, you end up being quite practical.
Got you. That's super cool. So that's a great lesson. Now, one thing that came more to mind is about fasting. This is something that I noticed that in Novo CEO, I listened to it. And it's actually one of the topics, something interesting about life, one of the topics I didn't connect to.
Mm.
And now I started in Chiang Mai, actually, to stop eating. I do one day a week of fasting.
That's what I do now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
which day of the week? You have
Mondays. Yeah.
Okay. And also, I stopped eating at 6 o'clock. That's my last
meal. Oh, that's
of
really
day.
Good.
Yeah, this is actually the big one.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting how you listen to a topic, you know, 3 years ago, and you're totally unconnected to it, and then it comes into barging into your life. So, yeah, maybe you can give us a quick intro about maybe fasting, how it transitioned for you. I think you also did it in more ultra way.
Well, let's just start a little bit with the kind of normal fasting. I've been experimenting with fasting since I was about 19. I think one of the reasons for me is I don't think my genes, my digestive system, nothing's that good. You know, there's a lot of people in my family who've got sort of slight digestive troubles, and I always kind of had a little bit of trouble, you know, bit of allergy to wheat. I'd often feel a bit kind of groggy after eating. So for me, fasting, I sort of quite naturally fell into it. But now it seems that there's quite a lot of science and converging on this idea that it's not just what you eat, it's like when you eat as well. That's an important part of the diet. There's some studies out now that it's an effective way of managing cancer as well as an effective potential anti-cancer strategy. I'm not a scientist and I can't quote the studies off the top of my head, it's a disclaimer. I mean, I started doing it because of the way it made me feel, but it seems the scientific community is now suggesting this is a good health strategy. I mean, specifically, like you, I do a 1 day a week fast where I just drink water or herb tea or coffee, but just zero calories. And then usually once a year, possibly twice a year, I do an extended fast, ideally a week. The goal of that is, that's the sort of anti-cancer strategy. That's kind of the main reason I do it, but also I just feel so good afterwards. What happens, apparently, is after a few days, your body switches from using a blood sugar energy source to what's called ketosis, where the body starts burning off proteins and fats. And the theory is it burns off the lower quality damaged cells first, which could include things like potential cancer cells. So there's a theory around there being anti-cancer. However, I would do it anyway, because at the end of that week, I just feel like I've got a new body. Like I'm more flexible, I just have this sort of sense of being lighter, and it's almost the high point of my year, actually. Probably is the high point of my year.
Wow.
So that's kind of what I do now. Back to the ultra stuff. Always, you know, I have to say this with a big disclaimer, because you really shouldn't try this. It was a very stupid thing I did. But when I was in my early 20s, I fell into this idea of becoming a breatharian. I mostly blame my friend whose idea it was to do it, and I just sort of wanted to keep up. But there's no science behind this, and people have died trying. But what I did do was actually quite remarkable. I don't know, I guess it's an interesting study into what the human body is capable of tolerating. So, the theory is you don't need to eat anything. You just survive off breath, which I think is nonsense, because that's not really what I did. I just went for an extended period, 3 weeks without eating. In fact, 7 days without drinking. That's the only thing that I did that was kind of significant.
Wow.
Science generally says 3 or 4 days without fluids and you will die. But I don't think that's been studied very carefully. And I was doing it at home, no stress. It wasn't like I was stranded in the desert or something. So perhaps the human body can last a bit longer than that. I mean, it's possible I might have brain damage or something. But anyway, don't do that. Whatever you do, do not try doing what I did, because it was very dangerous. And I some people have died following this process. Yeah, I kind of returned to a sort of fairly low calorie but more normal diet after quite some years, probably like 8 or 9 years. I did actually get quite ill, and I don't think it was just because of the fasting. I think it was because I was, you know, working too hard, not sleeping enough. You know, I was experimenting with my sleep as well, which is another really bad idea. I forget what it's called now, but I was trying that thing where you sleep for half an hour every 4 hours.
Yeah, I remember I heard about this. This is amazing.
God, just get as much sleep as your body wants.
It's the
best thing. Sleep is amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I kind of had this period of, I was really ambitious, working really hard, partying hard, dicking with my sleep, eating a low-calorie diet, and eventually it caught up with me, and I had the doctors say chronic fatigue, which just means they don't know why you're tired, but you're tired. And that was really horrible. I was like, I couldn't really do much work. I couldn't really do much for a few years. And anyway, thankfully, I'm back to normal now.
Yeah, I think it has to do with the nomadic lifestyle is also about experimenting, right?
Yeah.
But for me, sometimes I tell myself, you know, I already experiment with this lifestyle. Mm. Let's be totally normal in everything else.
Yeah.
With a little bit of a jump to the fringe when necessary, but yeah, for me, the fasting, I noticed one more thing is the psychological element of resisting your urge.
Yeah.
This gives me a lot of power, you know, that you shut down and you say, hey, I feel hungry.
Mm.
And because we're such in a society of abundance, mm-hmm. I can every time I could go to 7-Eleven and buy something, but I don't. And mm-hmm. for some reason, it gives you a lot of power for other things as well, because you're saying to yourself, I'm also a chocolate person. Ever since I started the 6 o'clock experiment, stop eating, I eat a lot less chocolate because I kind of like look at them and say, I stop eating at 6, I don't need you anymore. So basically, you see the psychological benefits there as well?
Yeah, totally. I've tried a lot of different diets over the years as well as fasting. And I just that sort of element of being disciplined, I've always got a real sort of, you know, power from that. It was just really empowering to just, I'm in control here. The urges that my animal body have aren't driving the ship. I'm steering the ship.
Yeah, and I think that especially on our lifestyle, because it can be so flexible and open and free, that if you don't put the discipline is one of the most important characteristics if we don't want to totally go off the rails. Yeah. So building your discipline could be something pretty interesting.
I got a couple of points on discipline since we're talking about it. I think there's two things here. Some people are really good with the all or nothing discipline. Like I've got a few friends who have been like 100% paleo diet, you know, never straying off it at all. And they say it's just simpler. It's like there's no kind of slip back into, you know, it's not like they smoke a cigarette every now and then and end up smoking again. It's like there's just clear line. Some people respond well to that. I think but there's other ways of doing it. Like I think moderation and setting sort of very kind of achievable goals is another way of doing it. So let's say you want to start flossing your teeth. You say, okay, I'm going to floss one of my teeth, just one tooth every day. And that's such an easy goal. I mean, it's just, how could you not do that? And in doing that, in achieving your goal, you get a certain sense of motivation and satisfaction. You might actually think, oh, I'll clean a few more teeth. And you might end up doing 5 of your teeth. And as you do it every day, it becomes a new habit. And then you think, well, I'll just do, you know, a quarter of my jaw every day. And so like setting these kind of smaller disciplines, I think is a good strategy for reaching the bigger ones.
Connects to your psychology when we started speaking, that you said have low expectation. You prefer people to also have low expectation of what you do and then surprise them.
I think that kind of that sort of gentle ramping up is a good strategy. So I mean, again, another parallel, it's a bit like starting several side businesses, which is sort of smaller effort rather than like the all in. I think, you know, both methods again can work, but probably for most people the sort of smaller gentle approach is the easiest way in.
That's cool, especially for us, you know, we're doing already experimenting with something that is not that normal, so taking it easy and not going all the way to radicalism or revolution or whatever might have really good effect. This has been very, very, very insightful interview. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Here. It's been a great chat.
Of course, when you get back to Hobo CEO, you have to let me know.
Yeah, so you'll come on our podcast.
That'll be great.
Yeah,
I hope you guys can pick it up again. And yeah, at the time being, where can people find you or connect with your project?
MrKirkland.com, that's my like sort of personal domain, which kind of links to everything I do. Mr. Kirkland on Twitter. And the Hobo CEO podcast is HoboCEO.com.
Excellent. So have a good one. Thanks.
Marvelous. Thank you.